Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today what we want to do is kind of pick up where we left off last week with the Amazon vote. You know, clearly down there in Alabama, the first union vote, trying to get the retail and department store union into Amazon. Roughly 5,800 eligible workers down there in that regional warehouse. And the vote, of course, came out, as we said last week, against the union. 1,800 voted no, about 800 voted yes, 500 ballots were contested. In other words, not determinative here for an outcome change. Out of 5,800. Of course, that tells you something. 5,800 eligible to vote, barely 3,000 voted, so, you know, just a little over half. Analyzing that will tell you what the problems were, to some extent, analyzing it. I'm not going to get into the Amazon vote analysis at this stage here. But just to say that I will be writing an article on it here, and you can check it out on my blog after this weekend at jackrasmus.com, because it is a kind of juncture in the evolution of union labor here, a juncture in which, of course, the union has lost the great opportunity to really rebuild the union movement here. And it's partly because, as I will argue today, relying on a procedure, a process of government-regulated and run union elections, which are really biased towards the employer. The employer has a great strategic advantage in opposing and stopping the advance of unionization through these NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, the agency that administers these elections. The company has a great advantage. Management has a great advantage. It wasn't always so. We're going to do a little historical review here of the rise and what I call the great detour of union labor that began in the late 70s, early 80s under neoliberalism. But before doing that, you know, it wasn't always that elections conducted by the government were really an obstacle to unionization. These elections really began with the passage in the 1930s, 1935, called the Wagner Act, sometimes really the National Labor Relations Act, the first legislation ever in this country to recognize the right of workers to have unions. You know, before that, it was illegal to have unions and to collectively engage together in trying to improve their wages and benefits, working conditions. It was illegal. That was considered a restraint of trade under the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act, which wasn't applied very much to businesses, you know, price fixing. But it, wage negotiations were considered price fixing. It was used against workers more than against companies. But that changed in 1935 with the passage of the Wagner Act, a.k.a. the National Labor Relations Act, a part of which recognized workers to have a union and also set up this structured process for workers through union elections on company sites to determine whether a majority of workers eligible to vote really wanted a union or not. You know, prior to that and during the 1930s, the way that workers got recognized by their employer and made the employer sit down and negotiate with them was to strike for recognition. And, of course, that's was the big thing that happened much of the 1930s. Workers were striking for recognition. So the law, in part, the Wagner NLRA, in part, was created to contain that very militant way of getting union recognition and negotiating a contract. That was the real function of the NLRA Wagner Act, to make a procedure out of it, overseen by the state, by the government itself. Initially, the act included provisions that made it illegal for the first time also for employers to try to threaten, intimidate, fire, and physically attack workers as they tried to strike for recognition, which was very much common in the 1920s and early 1930s. It was very brutal, very brutal. Employers would hire thugs and gangs and so forth to attack the workers on their picket lines and in other ways, assassinate the leaders. Kind of like what goes on in Colombia and Latin America today. You know, a union leader has a very short lifespan, and they simply find assassins, thugs, Proud Boys, right, whatever, to get rid of them. And that's the way it was in this country before 1935. So in a sense, the 1935 Act set up this procedure, but it also said that for the first time, workers had the right to organize, Section 7 of the Act, and Section 8 of the Act said certain activities by employers were illegal. Those activities, threatening and intimidating and, otherwise reducing workers' wages and hours of the organizers and so forth, that all became unfair labor practices, as the Act called it, ULPs. So there were some positive things about that Act, but it really went and funneled union recognition. In other words, you got to get recognized before by the employer, before the employer will sit down and negotiate with you. Another positive provision of the Wagner Act was that there could only be one union at a time for a group of workers called a bargaining unit, defined by the government once again. One of the favorite tactics of employers before the Wagner Act was to create multiple unions, often by their supervisors, to say, who do we negotiate with? There's three of you here, come on, you guys, you workers and your unions here, sort it out and we'll negotiate with one at a time. That was a way to keep, the workers fragmented and at each other. It was mostly company committees that were set up to claim they represented the workers, not the real bona fide workers' unions. So that was another tactic, and that was outlawed with the Wagner Act. In other words, only one union could represent a group of workers, which were called a bargaining unit. And bargaining units were divided roughly by those who were in, who made the goods, manufactured the goods. In other words, a productive unit, production unit, a unit, bargaining unit. And then there were blue collar units and skilled worker units, basically. And at that time in 1935, even supervisors could form a bargaining unit and have a union. So that was the Wagner Act, and it was really designed to stifle all these strikes for recognition, and it worked. It brought stability for the state, at least for the government, into the whole process here of recognizing unions. Was the prevailing, in the late 1930s, the prevailing way in which unions got recognized by employers. Workers were still striking for recognition as well. Did not want to wait for the months-long process that even then, back in the 30s, it took to have a union election vote. The big growth of unions, though, came during World War II. The big growth was the result of World War II. And of course, World War II, the government wanted to ensure as much production, particularly of war goods, as possible. and strikes, of course, disrupted production, and even union votes, union election votes under the agency NLRB of the NLRA Act took a while, and you know that disrupted production to some extent as well. So the government said, okay, you know, we're going to have an expedited way for unions to get recognition and workers to form a union, and that's called card check. In other words, all the unions had to do was get a majority of their workers to sign these little 3x5 cards or a petition. Usually it's 3x5 cards because a petition, you know, you can see who else signed it. These little 3x5 cards, yeah, I want a union to represent me. That's all you had to do and sign it. And if the union got a majority of those workers in a particular bargaining unit to sign up, then the employer had to negotiate. You know, the government would look at the cards and look at the total number of employees from the employer's hiring list and say, okay, there's a 51% majority here, employer, you got to sit down and negotiate. Well, that ended a lot of the disruption. It made it very easy for unions to expand membership and recognition. Which they did during World War II. The greatest growth of U.S. Union membership occurred during World War II as a result of card checks, you see. So union membership really expanded greatly during World War II. It expanded, of course, in the 30s after the Wagner Act to some extent, but really expanded after World War II. And, of course, during World War II, a lot of hiring, a lot of manufacturing, and all these workers had to, you know, were in unions because it was historically very much a demand of the unions that if you work here in a union contract, you got to join the union. That's called a union shop, okay? And, of course, pay union dues. That was all quite legal to negotiate. And during World War II, virtually everybody had to join the union if there was a union in your workplace. In 1946, to continue with this history, in 1946, the greatest strike wave occurred in U.S. Union history, the greatest strike wave. More workers went on strike than anywhere else historically at any time. Why? Well, because the war was ending, 1946. During the war, there was an exchange for this card check. Unions had to agree not to strike during the wartime. Part of that was also a wage freeze. Wage rates were frozen during World War II, and no strike agreements were common during World War II in exchange for the ease of organizing. You see, that was the trade-off. And the union bureaucracies love that trade-off. Yeah, we'll agree to no strike, just increase our membership. Mm-hmm. You know, the workers didn't mind so much the wage freeze because they were getting all these extra hours of work. You could work as much time as you wanted during World War II. You could work an 80-hour week if you wanted. So they were taking home a lot more income by extending their hours of work, not by raising their wage rates. There were exceptions to this in World War II. The very powerful Mine Workers Union and John L. Lewis, the leader of the Mine Workers Union, during World War II did strike. And it was a big stink. And, you know, they were declared, you know, unpatriotic and so forth. But what he, in other words, John L. Lewis, established for the first time was what's called health and benefits, health and welfare and pension funds for the mine workers. He struck over that and some wage increases and were able to increase for the first time bargaining over health care coverage and pension coverage for workers. You see, managers always had health care and pensions, but they never extended it to their workers. But John L. Lewis was able to achieve that. So he did violate the wage freeze during World War II. And of course, coal was, you know, the primary source of power. So the coal industry was just booming everywhere. All these hours of work part of the war mobilization plan of the government during the early 40s here was the industrial policy, let's call it, of, okay, unions can quickly form by card check. In exchange, there'd be a wage freeze and no strike agreements, even though, there were wildcat strikes and, of course, the mine workers, as I said. But union membership just ballooned. And then we had the great strike of 1946. Why? Because workers were concerned. They had a wage freeze during the war. They were concerned that the hours of work, now that the war has ended, would be sharply reduced, so their take-home pay would be sharply reduced. And prices were escalating rapidly right after World War II, as price controls were lifted first during World War II, but wage controls were not. Wage freeze was not. So workers went on strike, to solidify their income here as the war ended. That was the great 1946 strike. And other new industries, new sectors were organizing for the first time, like retail and so forth as well. This great strike wave caused the employers to be concerned. FDR was dead. The Democratic Party took a strong rightward imperialist shift after World War II. Truman and the CIA was formed, and a lot of markets to get control over in the vacuum that was left by the defeated countries. And, of course, England, Britain was defeated economically, and so was France. So the world was the great big pie for American capitalists to grab, and they grabbed it. And a very conservative group took over in the Democratic Party and, by the way, a rightward shift in the Republican Party. And the outcome of that was 1947, a law called Taft-Hartley, Taft being the senator, Hartley being the congressman. And what that did was the Taft-Hartley Act was to stop union organizing in its track, pretty much. The great organizing of the previous decade came to an abrupt halt. And Taft-Hartley is really an attack on unions and workers to offset the advantages created by the Wagner Act and World War II for unionization. Well, what did Taft-Hartley do? Taft-Hartley established union unfair labor practices. Remember, in Wagner Act, it said that the employer could not intimidate, threaten, fire, reduce hours, or whatever, because workers wanted to organize. Now they did. They imposed the similar limits on unions. In other words, unions could not threaten workers for not voting union, etc. But the big stick of Taft-Hartley was across the board, significant restrictions on the right to strike by workers. No more striking for recognition. If you struck for recognition, the government could step in and set up an election and saying, go back to work, and we're going to have this election. You had to, if you were had a contract and you were thinking of striking, you had to give the employer and the government 30-day notice. Well, 30 days from now, we're going to strike. And that still exists, by the way. In other words, no surprise strikes. No, you got to give the employer 30 days to prepare for your strike. Well, that's what one of the big changes that came out of this Taft-Hartley Act. Another was in national agreements. A lot of these agreements in steel and auto were nationwide, railroads, et cetera, that there had to be federal mediation. In other words, you got to give a 30-day notice, and you got to sit down with the government, employer, and union, and you got to allow the employer, the government, to try to forge an agreement between you two. And there are certain tactics that the way they do that. I've been in many mediation negotiations myself, so I know the game that they play. And in these national economic impact strikes, the government could order cooling off periods. In other words, go back to work. Yeah. And if you don't, of course, the government will sue you and even take over your union if you don't comply. And of course, sympathy strikes were outlawed. Workers in one company going on strike in sympathy for another company unrelated to them were clearly outlawed. Also, prior to Taft-Hartley, supervisors could form unions. Now that was outlawed. Supervisors could not form unions. It was ruled that they had a interest with greater interest with the employer and management, so they could no longer have foreman unions, right? Foreman supervisor unions. So across the board, you know, major, and this is just the major elements of Taft-Hartley. There's a lot of other things. It stopped the union expansion in its track in the late 40s. From that point on, really, union growth was only because industry was growing. And there wasn't so much, and there was some organizing going on, new organizing, but not that much. Predominantly in the early 50s, you know, U.S. Businesses were expanding as they, you know, absorbed the world markets. And consumer goods were being produced now for the first time at home. Growth in union membership was because of the growth in the industries, not so much adding new membership. And another significant loophole was closed, further limiting the unions in the 1950s, late 50s. And there was a loophole in the Taft-Hartley Act. That was called the Landrum-Griffin Act. And that ended secondary boycotts, strikes. What's a secondary boycott? Well, secondary boycott is when there's a relationship between workers in two companies, two separate companies. It might be two totally separate unions. But one company refuses in solidarity with the workers on strike, actual strike, economic strike, at one company. The other company workers refuse to handle the goods of that company. And that's usually, transport, Teamsters unions, you know, would secondary boycott a company. In other words, we refuse to pick up and deliver goods to this company, right? It's narrower than a sympathy strike, but it's still very similar to a sympathy strike. It's called secondary boycott, right? And sometimes, you know, skilled workers for maintenance workers coming on site and so forth would refuse to cross the picket line of the original strikers, and that's considered secondary boycott, right? But mostly it's handling transport goods. That's secondary boycott. Well, that loophole was closed, too, further limiting the right to strike. So from 47 to 59, you know, in the post-war period, capital is very powerful and capital comes down on its unions and their workers. You know, combined with this was the great anti-communist threat. Unions, about a dozen unions were identified as controlled by communist leaders and therefore were blackballed and driven out of the AFL-CIO, and the AFL-CIO, of course, played ball with business and the government to get rid of some of these unions, you know, like the ILW, Longshore Workers Union, the Siemens Union, and some others that were long-term militant and, pretty much became militant during the 1930s, a number of communist members. Most militant people in the unions there were leaders of them. Guys like Harry Bridges, you know, in ILWU, a very effective leader, led the San Francisco General Strike in 1934, built up the union, very powerful West Coast ports and warehouse workers, and pretty much controlled the ports, and a few other unions here and there. Well, you know, the politics, McCarthyism and all that, you know, attacking the unions in Hollywood, That was all part of this corporate offensive against unions. And, you know, one of the big effects was unionization pretty much came to a halt, union membership, right? Also, with Landon Griffin 59, opened up new ways the government can go after leaders of unions, which they did, of course. That was one of the ways they got, what's his name? Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa, right? Racketeering acts and so forth, claims. Okay, so, you know, that was the picture during the 1960s. Union growth through industry growth increased to some extent. And by the late 60s, you began to have organizing, successful organizing outside of the NLRA, the Wagner Act. You know, the Wagner Act, of course, applied to private sector businesses. Public sector, public workers were not organized. Farm workers were not unionized. They're outside the act. So they could strike for recognition, you see, and not violate the law. And we began to see that in the late 60s. City workers, garbage workers beginning, and other city workers began to unionize and strike for unionization, recognition. You know, that's one of the reasons they went after Martin Luther King, because he began to ally the civil rights movement with the union movement. And that was considered anathema. Uh-oh, can't do that, right? That might be too much to control. So we begin to see the rise of public sector unionism, state and local government, county government, right? In the late 70s, late 60s, and that expanded very much during the 1970s decade as well, unionization of the public sector. I was a union organizer back then with the Service Employees International Union, and we organized several cities and counties in California at the time. I was also an organizer with the hotel and restaurant workers, and with the Communication Workers of America and the steel workers. So what I'm telling you here is not just the history, but a personal experience, particularly with union elections, NLRB elections. I organized more than 20-some different companies using union election processes, because we had to in the 1970s. But workers were a lot more militant in the 1970s, and I'll explain why. Particularly younger workers who wanted their share in the newer industries and in some of the older industries as well. They weren't afraid to go on strike, and they were very pro-worker. But I'll tell you, to digress here on my own personal experiences in the 70s, I would never even file for a union NLRB election without 70% of the bargaining unit workers having signed cards that they wanted the union, you know, at least 70%, because I knew that the employer would engage in a host of illegal, sometimes not illegal, tactics that were allowed that would chip away at your vote. So when you came to a union vote, you had to have 50% plus one to require the employer to provide union recognition and sit down and bargain with the union. And of course, if you had a very narrow, close vote, the employer would not be very amenable to conceding wages and benefits. If you had 70% of the workers vote for the union, well, then that was a real signal to the employer, you know, you better sit down and negotiate realistically. So I would never file, and no smart union organizer would file for just a bare number on the card that said, you know, we want to have a union, right? Under the NLRB, signing these cards that the union turns over to the government, they're confidential, who signed the card, you know, does not give you immediate union recognition. It's not like World War II. It just says, okay, you got enough to set up an election here run by the NLRB, And in fact, under the law, the NLRA law, in the private sector, you could get 30%. All you needed was 30% of the workers to have an election. Well, never file for an election with 30% because you're already in a minority. You know, that's desperation. Sometimes unions would do that just to see how much real support there was in the bargaining unit, expecting a year later to come back and really organize. But I never did that. That was kind of a waste of time, I thought. You know, look, you know, the union does not convince workers to join the union. The employer convinces the workers, right? And if the employer hasn't convinced the workers, no amount of, you know, by taking away their conditions and their wages and so forth, no amount of union is going to, your organizer is going to talk them into, convince them and talk them into voting for the union. The employer always organizes the workers, and the union just sort of, you know, directs that discontent into a situation where it can sit down and bargain with the employer. Anyway, you know, I prevailed in 80% of my union elections during the 1970s because I never filed with less than 70%, and sometimes, you know, 80% of signed cards. That was a good sign. And also because you didn't want to get close to 50%, because then you would have a hell of a time negotiating a contract with the employer. I wonder what the retail and where, you know, department store employees, RWSDU or something, I think it's called, did at Amazon. I wonder how many cards of the 5,800 they actually got workers to sign before they went into the union election, you know. I suspect that it probably wasn't the 70%. It probably may have even been less than 50%. Strategic error, if that's what they did. Strategic error. It suggests the fact that you had almost 50% of the workers did not bother to vote. It suggests that maybe they did not have sufficient cards. Plus, you know, that may not be the only reason, but that could be one of the reasons. To get back to our little history of union membership and organizing, at its peak in the private sector, unions had about 35% in the late 50s, 35% of the workforce organized, you know, and that was like 35 million workers here, about 100 million workers in the labor force in the 1950s, maybe a little bit more. So it was like 35%. But in the basic industries, you know, like auto and steel and manufacturing and construction, it was like 70-80%. And those industries were unionized, those private sector manufacturing, goods producing, construction industries, right? 80%. Well, that's pretty effective bargaining leverage that you would have if you had 80% of the industry organized. Of course, that does not exist today. Anything nearly close to that does not exist. By the late 1970s, things began to shift dramatically. And in fact, even before that, the second greatest strike wave in this country occurred in 1970-71. The unions were, particularly in basic industries, manufacturing, construction, and transport, were very powerful and had reached the ability to have large regional agreements and national agreements, contracts, in other words, so they could shut down a whole industry. They could shut down the auto industry if they wanted, and the steel industry, and the trucking industry, long-haul trucking across state lines and so forth, and the ports if they wanted to. And they had agreed during the 1960s when the Vietnam War was going on and everything, had agreed with the Democrat Party friends not to strike. And in exchange, you know, the Democrats said, well, you know, we'll try to keep prices down and so forth. But they couldn't because the war, Vietnam War, and, you know, the Cold War and the space war was all overheating the economy. So prices began to rise in the late 70s. And when, 1968, 69, when Nixon comes in, the unions figure, well, it's time to recoup the loss in our wages due to inflation over the 70s. And we get this major strike wave, very powerful unions in 70, 71. Unions were at their peak, really. And they were able to get settlements, win strikes with incredible gains in wages and benefits. You know, very typical was a 25% increase in wages and benefits in the first year of a three-year agreement. Imagine that, 25% raise in 1 year. Ho, you know, with another 3, 4, 5% in the second and third year. Well, and the employers couldn't stop them. That's why the employers called in Richard Nixon to impose a wage freeze and to roll back those gains. The gains were first in construction industry, led the way, and then the Teamsters who, carry goods back and forth on construction sites and realize that, hey, you know, these carpenters and guys are making 25% raises. We better get it, too. And so it spilled over to Teamsters and trucking, and from there it spilled over to other manufacturing, auto and steel and so forth. And from there it spilled over to longshore, in other words, ports and docks and so forth. And massive gains. I remember the longshore workers' strike in San Francisco Bay in 1971. And at that time, there were like 40 ships at anchor in the bay. They couldn't dock because of the strike. You know, I mean, that was real power at the time. But they had to bring in the capitalist state in order to put a halt to it all. And they did. And Nixon rolled back all those gains to 5.5% wage increases and froze wages and then put a control on wages for another couple years. That was 72 and 73. And only when Nixon got in trouble, 73, 74, with Watergate and so forth, the wage and price controls came off, and inflation occurred, and then the government imposed a slowing of the economy and a very terrible recession, 73 to 75. And that took back a lot of the gains of the 5.5% in the early 70s. So the state, the capitalist state, and the government came in on the side of the employers and rolled back the gains. But at this time, outside the NLRA, we had organizing going on, not just in the public sector, but the farm workers for the first time. And we had also the healthcare hospital workers for the first time were able to organize. But those were outside the NLRA and its limits on strike. Okay, and the farm workers would strike for recognition, you know, public workers would strike for recognition. And this was going on, in all these new sectors that weren't covered under the restrictions of Taft-Hartley, Landrum-Griffin, and all the courts' restrictions and so forth that existed at the time. At the same time, in the early 70s, we had all these social movements that were, you know, the environmental movements, the women's movement, blacks and Chicanos and civil rights and so forth. All these social movements were exploding at the same time. But the social movements and the union militancy never linked up, you see. That was a big failure of progressive developments. It never linked up because the Democrats, of course, did not want them to link up. The impact of the great strike wave, the state came in and the political parties of the capitalists came in and put a damper on it all and stopped it. At the same time, business began to reorganize in the early 70s under this threat. And business began to realize that they better get better organized. The organization really started reorganization of business in the construction sector. The construction sector employers got together, created a round table, came out with new strategies to stop the unions, construction unions. The most successful, of course, was called the construction industry double-breasted operations. In other words, the companies would create separate companies, the construction companies, outside of the big cities. In the big cities, they had to pay union wages, and they had one company there. But outside where suburbia was expanding and housing, they had another company that was non-union. And of course, over time, the non-union operation began to creep into the urban centers and take over more and more of that business. And that's how they pretty much stifled the construction unions. And then court decisions and NLRB decisions came out that said picketing, union picketing on construction sites had to be limited to only two people, right? Two people per entrance instead of mass pickets. The unions tried to counter that with what was called the situs right picketing legislation, but that was shot down in the 70s under Jimmy Carter. And coming out of the Watergate and the 73-75 recession, very severe, Jimmy Carter and businesses got together and helped put together a strategy to pretty much stifle the unions and their further recovery and growth. And the key event was the Chrysler strike in 1979 set the pattern for what would be neoliberalism, industrial policy, union, anti-union strike, industrial policy under Reagan that began in the 1980s. You know, neoliberalism has a set of four policies, basically, that are clearly identified as neoliberal. In other words, different than the pre-1980 capitalist policy. Policies, fiscal policies, spending policies, tax policies, monetary policies, which is interest rate and central bank monetary policy. And then, of course, what we call trade policy, external policy, and then, of course, industrial policy. Well, neoliberal industrial policy had certain characteristics to it, beginning with Reagan, actually originating in some ways under Jimmy Carter. You can read my thorough analysis of how neoliberal policies, these four policies, are different from pre-neoliberal and how the neoliberal policies have evolved, including industrial policy, in my latest book published 2020 called The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. You can check that out on my blog and website, jackrasmus.com, or just go to Amazon, whatever. Okay. Or you can check out, in 2020, I gave several talks on the show about what neoliberalism was and where it was going and the crisis it was entering. But it really begins, the industrial policy that we know today really begins neoliberal industrial policy under Reagan. What was this policy? And of course, deunionization, conscious deunionization, was part of this policy under Reagan, right? How did they deunionize, in other words, reduce union membership? Well, by offshoring U.S. manufacturing, basic industry, where unions had the greatest membership. They did this by encouraging tax cuts for businesses to invest overseas and move overseas. Yeah, government actually paid cut taxes if you move jobs offshore. And other deregulations involved. We saw the growth of part-time workers during the 1980s as well. And it was ruled by courts in the NLRB that part-time workers did not have a community of interest with the union workers in the bargaining unit. So they were outside the bargaining unit, so unions could not negotiate for them. Well, that was an incentive for employers to take full-time jobs that were under the union and say they were part-time and move them outside of the union, right? Another tactic was to deregulate transport and communication industries, allowing all sort of new fly-by-night competitors to enter, and that would create more competition, and therefore competition, you'd get the employer to lower the wages of the workers in those unions. I mean, a good example was transport and the Teamsters Union, and the airline unions and the telephone unions. Right, deregulation really did a trip on wage gains and membership in those basic industries, as well as part-time or what we call contingent labor, contingent to the main bargaining unit, not really part of it, right? And offshoring. The government encouraged poor leadership in transitions into unions as well. Most notorious was in the Teamsters Union, it encouraged Tony Provenzano, who was a mafia guy, clearly from New Jersey, to take over the Teamsters Union. And he agreed to eliminate national over-the-road trucking contracts, union contracts. He devastated the union. In other words, the capitalists will use the crooks whenever they can to undermine the union as well. Then there was the great PATCO, air traffic controllers strike that Reagan directly broke. The AFL-CIO national unions sat on their local unions that were striking in protest against what was happening in the first term of Reagan. The most infamous was the meat cutter strike, and that kind of led to the destruction of unionization in meat cutting. And AFL-CIO, as well as the Democrats, thought that Reagan was only temporary, that Reagan would soon be changed, and we'd go back to the old thing. And of course, they never did. Outsourcing, as well as offshoring, outsourcing is just domestic, moving jobs and sections, maintenance and whatever, out of the bargaining unit, given it to some third company. Concession bargaining took hold during the 1980s. The courts ruled that there was, if you had a grievance procedure, it was implied no strike. You couldn't strike, even though your contract did not say a no strike agreement. It was implied it was there if you had a grievance procedure, and everybody had a grievance procedure, right? And the rise of anti-union busting law firms became a billion-dollar industry. How to destroy unions or prevent them from coming in. And this is where we get back to Amazon and what was happening with Amazon here today, because, it's become a real science, a billion-dollar industry of law firms designed just to stop union elections. And what are some of the things they do, some of the tactics that they do? It's illegal for the employer to directly threaten workers, but there's ways of wording now that gets across the message that if the union comes in, you could lose your job, right? If the union comes in, you could not get wage increases. It's all bargainable, right? No guarantee you're going to get a wage increase. Union comes in, doesn't stop the company from continuing to find efficiencies in its wages, its health care and pension benefits, right? You could end up in less while you're paying more union dues, right? You can't say that directly if you're an employer. But you can point to other examples, you see. You can do that, and that's what they do. It's a strong message, and the law firm knows how to deliver that message in various forms, right? Another big tactic that the employers use to thwart union elections, and I'm sure they did this at Amazon, was to set up employee anti-union committees out of the workforce. In other words, those who are kiss asses and looking for promotions in the management, right? Become the leader of groups of employees who say, the rest of you should vote against the union. And the courts have ruled that employees can lie like hell. The employer can't threaten. The employer can't promise benefits. But these employee unions can lie like hell, right? And of course they do. And the law firms know how to educate them and direct them and manipulate them. Supervisors can pretty much suggest a lot of negative developments if the unions come in. They have to be a little more careful than the employee committees. But typically they say, union dues will cost a lot, right? More than you're going to pay. You have no control over it, right? We can't promote anybody or give any wage increases while this election is going on. And when the union comes in, we have to agree to wage changes for jobs, not for individuals, you know? And so if you're a great employee, we can't just give you extra, you know? We're limited by the union to give it to the job you've got, not to you personally, right? We can't raise benefits during the election. Another big tactic is captured company meetings on company time, right? Right before the election, the company holds meetings. Everyone's got to attend the meeting. Everyone's got to listen to the leaders of the anti-union employee group giving their pitch to everybody all at once. And the employer suggesting and pointing to things, it's a major tactic that the employers use, right? And even if the union wins the election, the employers then challenge it, you know, on a whole number of bases and delay the certification of the results of the election for months. They can do it and typically do it for months. During that time, they say they can't give wage increases or benefit changes and so forth. During that time, they intimidate the union organizers, rank and file organizers on the job. They refuse to negotiate in good faith. After a year, they can then call for a decertifying of the union election, which they often do, right? They can harass workers. Delay, delay, delay is what it's all about. That's what's union elections have become. So even if the Amazon workers had won, you can be damn sure that a multi-billion dollar company like Amazon would delay, 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 and they probably would never get a contract because, look, you know, if they let it in Bessemer, Alabama, let the union in, it would set off a firestorm of union organizing everywhere else. They know that. They would do everything, expend every kind of money, every kind of legal tactic to prevent the vote from being certified if the Amazon workers had won. And even if it is certified, they would then stonewall and not negotiate. Those are typical tactics. There's a lot of other tactics, you know, but those are typical tactics we get this neoliberal industrial policy, and it's pretty much stopped organizing in its track. Now, you know, what happened under Obama was that he promised to do something about this. He had promised to do card checks. In other words, like World War II, where workers just signed these cards, and then, the union was in. He promised that, but he sat on it, never got out of committee, didn't do a damn thing for the unions, even though they got him in, right? And now, of course, we got under the Democrats another set of promises, which are going to be very hard to deliver here, given the Republican and filibuster and Republican influence in the Senate, called the PRO Act, Protecting Right to Organizing Act of 2021. This was actually passed originally by the House last year, repassed again in March. It's in the Senate Health and Education Labor Committee here. But the filibuster, if they don't stop the filibuster, it will never get to a floor vote, right? What are some of the reforms of the PRO Act? We should say that in closing here very quickly. One, new union election rules to make it fairer for the union, right? And if the employer refuses to agree to a contract, there's an arbitration panel that will impose a two-year contract within 90 days. The employer has to agree to a contract in 90 days, or the government mediation panel it'll be a bare bones one, but at least they'll get the union established, right? The employer can't lock out workers in strikes. That's a typical employer tactic, you know, to refuse to allow them to actually come back to work. Permanently replace strikers. That's a big threat for the workers when they go on strike, right? Allow short-term work stoppages, which are illegal by law now. Expand what's called the joint employer in construction. Also, the PRO Act would weaken prohibitions on secondary boycotts. Very significant, very significant. And allow workers to participate in secondary boycotts, right? And prohibit company claims against unions, you know, because if there was a secondary boycott up until now, the employer could sue the union for all the damages and break the union financially. And that's a great incentive for union bureaucrats at the very top to say, oh, stop it, you know, imposed it on their own workers. It allows workers to file unfair labor practices in court to recover back pay, damages, and lawyer fees, not just the union. You see, under Section 8, it's just the union can file unfair labor practices against the employer and the employer against the union. But now employees, the workers themselves, with damages, could file for being fired and whatever, right? Managers and corporate officers would be personally liable. You know, they could go to jail here under this act if they engage in anti-union, anti-worker activity. A broader definition of what's an employee and a supervisor. It allows, permits agency shop and collective bargaining agreements. What's an agency shop? It's simply that everybody who's covered by the union contract has to pay a union fee for the cost of negotiations and administration, right? That can be negotiated up until recently, and now court decisions said recently, no, you can't even impose an agency shop. In other words, people can... without paying anything, without joining the union, without paying fees, can get the benefit of negotiations, right? That's part of the attack, the right to work attack on unions that's been intensifying over the last decade. Well, the PRO Act would say there can be agency shops in union agreements, right? It would be illegal for companies to require workers to attend these captured meetings designed to discourage them at the last minute, right, during election campaigns. It would prohibit a company requiring workers to sign individual agreements to waive some of their rights to engage in collective activity. It would allow workers to engage in class action suits against the employer. It would prohibit company action against workers for engaging in this kind of protected activity, like filing individual unfair labor practices, right, and participating in unfair labor practice NLRB hearings, right? It would expand union election voting rights. In other words, union workers could vote, not by having to go on site and put your vote in a box there with the supervisor watching you. Right? Management watching you. Of course, they don't know how you voted, but they know you voted, right? It would allow workers to vote by telephone or internet. Big fight over indirect voting rights going on at all levels in American society right now. And there would be penalties and injunctions for company failing to comply with NLRB orders. In other words, if they refuse the same agreement in 90 days, there could be an injunction and penalties. So the PRO Act is very good. The PRO Act is very progressive in a whole number of ways, but it won't get out of committee in the Senate, I think. And, you know, it's the latest step in this push and pull of destroying union rights and the right to organize. It would be more of a level playing field here if it were imposed, but Amazon shows it's not a level playing field. And, you know, what happens next at Amazon could be greatly influenced. But, you know, we have this long term, as I call it, the great detour of labor since the late 1970s, early 80s under neoliberals, and that has destroyed union membership. Private sector, only 5% union organized now compared to 35%. Before all the neoliberalism began. Okay, so that's the picture here of the great detour of union labor, the latest example of which was Amazon, of course. The results still to be determined, but I'm not too optimistic that the AFL-CIO and the Democratic Party are going to be able to turn the great detour around. Amazon was the great opportunity, but they lost it, I think, because they did not treat it as really the strategic juncture of labor that it potentially could have been. Okay, that's it for today, and